Over 1,300 people died in extreme heat during the Hajj in Mecca 2024. But experts can only guess how many people die each year from climate-driven extremes. We do not know the cumulative long-term toll of repeated attacks on our health due to climate change, and this is a big knowledge gap. Professor Dan Mitchell just published Why We Still Don't Know the Mounting Health Risks of Climate Change. Dan is professor of climate science at the Cabot Institute for the Environment at the University of Bristol, UK. From Bristol, Dan Mitchell, welcome to Radio EcoShock. Your article was published by the premier journal Nature in January. You make a point that may be new to some of our listeners and doctors. What do you mean by cumulative health effects during climate disruption? At this point, there was a problem in my studio which made Dan's first response hard to understand. I'm going to read out his reply, and then we resume the interview as it should be. Dan said, during my article, I'm very clear that we should start distinguishing between fast and violent, so things like heat waves or storms or cold snaps, from slow onset events, so things like gradual rising of the background temperature, or persistent air pollution changes from different wildfire locations. And so really what I mean by cumulative effects is how do those combinations of different disasters mount up to account for a sort of invisible toll of mortality, which is not perhaps seen on TV, the news, that sort of thing, because it's a longer-term thing to capture. So that was what Dan Mitchell said, and now we go to our full interview. Well, let's take one example. Here in the West, we tend to breathe a lot of wildfire smoke, especially in the last few years. It's even worse if a city burns like Los Angeles, where the cities are full of toxic plastics and chemicals. It may not kill us directly, but is there evidence wildfire smoke could make us very sick or lead to death later? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there is evidence that wildfire smoke will kill directly, actually. If someone's particularly prone to respiratory illness, they might be a very strong asthmatic, you can see that happen immediately. That person would probably go to A&E first and then die later in hospital. But yes, my main point is that actually cumulative exposure of air pollution like that over a long period, we know there are significant poor health outcomes from that. What we don't know are the absolute numbers on how many people are getting iller, what the number of years of life lost, for instance, for people in these populations. So, you know, where you guys are in the West, then it's not just about where the wildfires are burning. It's about where the winds are blowing the pollutants, and these can be hundreds of kilometers downstream of the fires, for instance.
And you also write about heat waves and kidney disease. I was unaware of that connection. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so kidneys can respond in very, very unique ways, I guess, to certain stressors. So if you get electrolyte imbalance, if you become dehydrated, for instance, then kidneys can be damaged. And so when we talk about kidney disease, we're talking about essentially worsening kidney function over time. And sometimes these things can be quite sudden. You know, something can go inside you and you would go into A&E, for instance. But often it's just making these things work in a poorer way. And so a lot of maybe developed countries, you see more kidney disease because of prolonged drought. And, yeah, those sort of things filter through when you get extreme events, but there's a background health change as well.
Are we seeing evidence of these cumulative health impacts in excess death statistics, or how would we know?
In terms of looking at the actual mortality data and long-term exposures, it would be extremely difficult to quantify this. And this is sort of my point in the paper is, you need decades of reliable health data before you would see a signal like this. So the real issue is if we want to wait for some of that, then we're going to have to wait for more decades, and then we can go back and say, oh, yes, all that exposure occurring 30, 40, 50 years ago was having really bad effects. So one of the points of the paper is, if we've got strong physiological evidence for this sort of thing, then we should be including these in our risk assessments already. So one example is, for instance, we know air pollution, if you breathe it in directly through your nose, it can directly impact on your brain. So we know that there's a link between dementia and air pollution. Now, if you were to calculate the number of people who dementia has been progressed more quickly because of this, that number doesn't exist. We don't have the sort of data you would need to calculate that number, which is a problem because it means we can't include it in climate change risk assessments. However, we know that it is a problem because we've seen it in certain case studies, we've seen it in the lab, we've seen it when we've looked at people's brains who've been exposed to these things. So we know it's happening, but we can't quantify it, so it doesn't appear in our assessments, and that's a real problem.
In one of your earlier studies, you looked at wildfire risks in the United Kingdom. Now, I don't usually think of the Jolly Green Land as the spot of wildfires, but what did you find?
No, exactly right. So, I mean, there are thousands of wildfires in the UK every year, actually, but they're not nearly as dramatic as what other countries, especially the LA wildfires or Australia, Turkey, those sort of regions. They're much smaller field fires or moorland fires. But in the case of our study, there was a larger wildfire and it did start burning buildings on the outskirts of London. So we've got a lot of interest here. So yeah, countries like the UK can have wildfires, but they're significantly less of a risk than many other countries, like Turkey, for instance.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, speaking about the health cost of repeated climate stressors.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We're back with Dr. Dan Mitchell talking about your health and climate change. Well, speaking of extreme heat, though, you also co-authored a study finding scorching heat over 50 degrees C is rapidly increasing in parts of the Mediterranean and the Middle East due to human influence. That was published a year before Greece hit 44 degrees C in June 2024. The Acropolis had to close and tourists, including British tourists, died in the heat, like the British TV presenter Michael Mosley. Several places in the Middle East did hit 50 degrees Celsius, that's 122 Fahrenheit, during the 2024 summer. So what are your expectations, having done that previous study?
Yeah, well, it's exactly as you say, you know, 50 degrees, there's nothing special that happens at 50 degrees Celsius, but it is economically a very important number. So a lot of countries actually have 50 degrees as a threshold where they'll stop outdoor workers, they'll still pay them, for instance, so it's an economic thing, and a lot of alert systems go into place. So it's a very important number structurally for many countries, especially countries, say, in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, those sort of countries where you can get those sort of temperatures. So it was important to show that rise and the fact that countries in southern Europe would start to see some of these things. As you rightfully said, during particularly hot extreme, then Michael Mosley unfortunately passed away due to heat stress. Now, he was an incredibly well-informed doctor. He knew this stuff as much as anyone, and yet he still, you know, heat stress still got him, and that really goes to show that these things are lethal, and you have to take them very seriously, even though you can be very well informed. His situation was a bit different because he got lost on a trail, but still, we often say things like carrying extra water and things like that can really help save lives here.
And scientists on this program and everywhere are saying extreme events will be worse and will come more often due to greenhouse changes. And another worry we have here is that it could affect babies in the womb. It's dangerous for pregnant women, and then, of course, the babies may be affected for life afterwards. Did you talk about that in your short article in Nature?
Yeah, so the effect of weather and weather-related stress on pregnancy is becoming a much larger area of research. You know, in a sense, every one of the mothers listening to your program will know that it's incredibly stressful when you're pregnant. And in normal stress situations, then you can feel it even more so. So there's a clear logical reason to think that if you're pregnant and a huge heat wave is going off, things are going to get bad. There have been some direct studies, though, that which have followed the child once it's been born through actually decades of its life after very stressful in utero weather event conditions. Some has been the Canadian outage, the storms in 1998 in Quebec. There's a cohort of children that have been followed from that event, and so that was a month of power outages during a very large snowstorm, for instance, in Quebec. And they saw that later down the line, 20 years down the line, these children had higher mental health problems compared to other children born at that time, including things like anxiety and depression and PTSD.
They say people can die of a broken heart, and do we know whether just stressing about storms or heat waves actually leads to poor health? Dan, does news of disasters possibly damage us even if we don't go through them personally?
Disasters can make people upset, that's true. I think that the bigger problem is probably this idea of climate anxiety. So that's the idea that climate change as a whole is going to bring particularly problematic weather conditions. In some cases, people talk about not having a future, or the Earth as we know it's going to be very different. And I think there's a communication problem there. Very few real scientists are saying that climate change is going to end the world, or it's just not a livable future for most of us. What we're saying is things are getting worse. We're saying that everyone's health will be impacted in a way, and maybe you have to take more precautions. Maybe you need to spend more of your money on adaptation. Maybe you need to be more wary of communities which don't have a lot of money, especially in the developing world. And I think some people have taken this idea a bit too far, and they kind of feel like they can't have a family because the world's going to be too bad in the future. That's absolutely not what the science is saying. The science is saying that overwhelmingly a world population, we will be worse off, and it's something we should try and avoid as much as possible. But it's definitely not the end of things. It's just making life more difficult. And I think we need to communicate those points more clearly. There's no doubt that acting now, stopping climate change, will save lives, and it will save a hell of a lot of money. But, yeah, there's a nuance there that should be made quite clear. And I think especially some of our younger climate change supporters may be thinking that we're saying something a bit more world-ending than we actually are in this case.
Well, humans have a tendency for that. People have been talking about that since the Middle Ages and before, that the end of the world is coming and they expect it. Now, I would like to add a note for our listeners. It's news about another study finding climate change is linked to worsening brain diseases. In June, a big team of medical professionals published a study on climate change and disorders of the nervous system. It was in The Lancet Neurology. They say, quote, evidence suggests that the incidence, prevalence, and severity of many nervous system conditions, for example, stroke, neurological infections, and some mental health disorders, can be affected by climate change, end quote. So we can add brain damage and mental health problems, possibly, to climate change. Does that fit in with what you know, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you really step back and think about this problem, we as humans have evolved to the weather on our planet. That's how evolution works. Climate change is changing that weather at a very rapid rate. So just from a basic logical standpoint, we're so ingrained with the weather and everything that we do that if we change that in a quick way, it becomes very clear as to how this might affect every aspect of our health. And our job as scientists is really to try and quantify that, try and come up with solutions which mitigate against that.
And the new concept in your Nature article, and this probably applies to a lot of living things, so well beyond humans, it's repeated trauma from ongoing climate disasters may add up to significant tolls on our health. That sounds important for medical practitioners, but also governments trying to plan responses. Dan, why don't we know more about this?
There are a couple of different pathways. The first is when you start thinking about things in the longer term, our models become infinitely more complex. And you could see that if you took a single person, if they were exposed to a flash flood, which typically occurs over a couple of hours, you could very clearly say what's happened to that person during that flood. However, if you took that same person and said, well, let's trace their life over the next 30 or 40 years and see how climate has changed their life, you would have to know exactly where they've been, which countries they've lived in, have they spent more time indoors or outdoors. All of these other sort of causal factors come into play, and it becomes much more difficult to say, yes, the increase in temperature alone was what caused these problems in this person. It could be the fact that that person is getting older, and in older people they see those problems. It could be that at some point in their life they develop some sort of infection which makes them much more susceptible to certain things. It could be that they started off in a very rich family but went into poverty. All of these other socioeconomic factors, these geographical factors, are really hard to disentangle over the longer term. But on the shorter term, for say the flash flood or the short heat wave, then you know all of these at that instant. And that's one of the real problems with this longer term burden.
From your time as a research scientist at Oxford, you worked on a range of climate issues, such as the polar vortex, for example. What steered you toward investigating the health impacts of climate change?
Well, the health impacts are some of the most direct things we can see for climate change. There's also so much to be done on the methods to really understand these pathways. You mentioned the paper about brain damage in The Lancet. You know, that's a very significant finding that was not particularly well known before. And it's such a rapidly moving field that we're always finding these sort of connections that perhaps we didn't even think about beforehand, and so it makes it a very important field to be in at the moment. It's also the one area where we really feel we can go to our governments around the world and we can point at data and we can say, look, here's the amount of people dying because of inaction of climate change. Here's what you can do to help prevent them die. And by the way, you should be cutting carbon emissions as well, because otherwise you're just putting a plaster over the problem. Clearly that doesn't work with every government. I'm not going to mention names, but I'm sure your viewers can guess who I'm talking about. One of the real issues is governments often come in cycles, often 4 or 5 year cycles, and what one government might want to do or invest in is not necessarily what another one might be, and that really slows the progress towards net zero.
Well, as we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like listeners to know about climate change and their health?
The only thing I would say is there's a lot you can do personally for your own health. And, you know, heat waves is one of the biggest killers globally. There's quite a bit people can do just to prevent these sorts of things. In that case, it might be checking up on elderly relatives. It might be drinking more water. It might be changing the way you open or close windows or curtains in your house, for instance. So for a lot of these problems, there are pretty logical and simple solutions. That's absolutely not always the case, especially for populations in poorer parts of the world. But my point to your viewers are there's a lot you can do yourselves to make your families and your close friends resilient to these sort of extreme events. It's not all about governments or other organizations doing it.
From the University of Bristol, we've been speaking with Professor Dan Mitchell. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.